From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. In 1893, a university teacher named Catherine Bates was on a cross-country train ride when she wrote the words to a poem she first called Pike's Peak. The title was, of course, a reference to one of the most recognizable mountains in the United States, which is located in central Colorado. And it's the Purple Mountain whose majesty Bates references in the song we all know now as America the Beautiful. Before getting to Colorado, though, Bates traveled through Kansas, where she also wrote of the gently swaying wheat that blankets this nation's Midwest and Southern Plains regions. Those are those famous amber waves of grain. And I was thinking about those words a few years ago when I decided to pull up a long-running agricultural harvest record from Kansas, which has been maintained there since the mid-1800s, further back than Bates's trip across the country. I also drew from several large models of global patterns of ocean temperatures that are based in part on shipping and naval records that go back just as far. And it turns out that there is a pretty robust connection between ocean temperatures in the Pacific and exceptionally bountiful and meager harvests in Kansas that some farmers are now using to help make decisions about what kinds of wheat to plant and when in a place long known as the Wheat State. And this was a neat finding, but it's not particularly revolutionary. Scientists have been identifying associations between ocean patterns and crop yields for decades, particularly in connection to the fluctuations of sea surface temperatures and wind patterns. This is known as the El Niño Southern Oscillation, which most of us know as El Niño and La Niña. Climate scientists are, right now, predicting a shift from a weak La Niña into neutral conditions, with a smaller growing chance of an El Niño moving into the coming year. And at times of shift like this, we often talk about the patterns of precipitation and temperature that are most likely under those sorts of conditions. And sometimes, especially in places where the patterns have been shown to offer us some insights about crop yields, we talk about the likely effects on farmers and agricultural markets in specific places like Kansas. But Weston Anderson thinks we should be thinking bigger. Because while we most often think about these things regionally, we can also use what we know about ENSO and other climate oscillations to predict what is most likely to happen to crops at a global scale. And Anderson says we need to, because in failing to see the forest for the trees, we're missing out on a crucial indicator for global food security. Anderson is an agroclimatologist who studies the dynamics of climate variability and its relation to food security, and many of his recent studies relate to how climate models can offer insights into crop yields at a global scale. Weston Anderson, welcome.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Weston, I started thinking about these connections fairly recently when I was reflecting on some words to a famous song that references wheat in Kansas. You began thinking about this much earlier, back in the early 2010s, when you were first trying to use predictive models for soil moisture so that you could monitor drought in eastern Africa. That's, of course, an area famously associated with agricultural drought. Tell me, what drew you to understanding crop yields in that region of our world?
As you mentioned, in eastern Africa, where this is much more of a subsistence agroecosystem, and livelihoods depend both on crop production and also on livestock, it was really a particularly intense drought that led to near famine conditions in 2011 and famine conditions in 2012 that really drew me to the region.
Let's pan out a little bit and talk about what is going on here. So, and let's stick with Eastern Africa. How do ocean temperatures in the tropical Pacific impact agriculture on the other side of the planet?
For those that aren't as familiar with what the El Niño Southern Oscillation is, it's a coupled pattern of ocean and atmospheric conditions where you get either a warming or a cooling of the eastern tropical Pacific that affects precipitation in that region, in the eastern Pacific. But what happens there doesn't stay there. It alters global patterns of circulation and affects the probability of precipitation and affects growing season temperatures really all over the Earth through these atmospheric circulations, or what we often refer to as teleconnections. And so this is particularly relevant throughout Eastern and Southern Africa, as well as in major production regions like the Southern Great Plains of the United States, as you mentioned.
And it's important to say here that these are fluctuations that are fairly predictable. We can increasingly, not perfectly, but increasingly, we're getting better and better at seeing El Niños and La Niñas come. And increasingly, we're getting better and better at saying what that means for weather patterns all across the globe in different ways. And in some places, El Niño is positive for agriculture. In some places, it's negative. The same for La Niña. Same even for neutral conditions. But it's not a wash. It doesn't necessarily all balance out at a global scale.
Right. And it's interesting that ENSO does not globally tilt the odds towards drought or tilt the odds towards wet conditions, but it really redistributes the probability of drought over both subsistence agricultural areas and major agricultural areas. And in a world where the majority of food calories are traded internationally, that's important because it imposes a structure of risk on our food system. And what I mean by that is that generally, agricultural markets, we kind of assume that good production harvests in one location will mitigate the poor production elsewhere. In other words, you're sort of balancing out your good harvest with your poor harvest so that you've got relative stability from year to year on a global food production basis. But during these El Niño or La Niña years, you're kind of breaking this assumption because no longer is it true that what happens in Argentina, in the United States, and Africa and China is unrelated. Generally, you would assume these are all sort of unrelated events, but during these strong ENSO events, that's no longer the case.
And you've pointed out that global trade has been, overall, it's been pretty good for making sure that even when a country like, say, Ethiopia in Eastern Africa has an agricultural drought, there's still lines of food that are incoming. And this is one of the major reasons why more people have access to an adequate number of calories today than ever before. But also, people are increasingly reliant. Some people are wholly reliant on global trade for that access. And that's comes with a different set of problems.
Yeah, you see a little bit of both of that in that during, for example, the crop failures across Southern Africa just last year, we saw that some of the impact of that could be mitigated by trade from Tanzania, which is far enough north that it wasn't hit by the same drought. And so that's a good example of an instance where, although a regional scale drought led to crop failures across Zimbabwe and South Africa and Malawi and Zambia, there was some regional availability of food that could at least mitigate the food accessibility shortage, right? And so in that sense, global trade and the free flow of agricultural commodities can be a real positive for food accessibility. The free flow of food trade, of food in international trade, is consistently identified as one of the important aspects of maintaining food security in times of food production shocks.
Let's throw another variable into this, because one of the things you pointed out is it's not just climate fluctuations making overall crop yields better or worse at a global scale. It's how that happens in association with other things that impact crop availability, like, for instance, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which is a major global wheat provider, among other crops. The big risks really come where geopolitical events like that coincide with a time in which climate patterns are making crop growth in other areas more difficult as well.
Yeah, and this is true both for crop growth and for the knock-on effects on food security. what actually leads to good or poor harvest is far beyond climate. In fact, the best estimates are that globally climate accounts for, and climate variability accounts for, about a third of crop production variability year on year. And the rest of it is due to things like management and pests, maybe conflict, socioeconomic constraints. So all of the factors that really go into these social systems that are so important in agriculture, and that's just for food production. Once you get to things like prices and food security, you're really looking at socioeconomic systems on top of the physical agroecosystem.
You've been thinking about this at the global scale since at least the mid-2010s. In 2017, you presented your research at the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union. And you said basically, hey, everybody, when we put all these regional connections together, they tell us something about food at a global scale. And I wasn't there at that meeting. I wasn't even a climate scientist yet at that time. But I imagine you like standing on tables and screaming and like waving a red flag.
Well, maybe not quite that dramatic, but I do think that it's well past time that we start to consider the global implications of these global scale modes of climate variability. This comes a little bit from my perspective working in the reinsurance industry briefly, where the approach to many of these physical catastrophes are that you consider them from a risk analysis perspective, and you consider how to mitigate these events by pooling your risks in a way that you're presumably pooling uncorrelated events to increase stability. And while we've known for a very long time about the global implications of things like the El Niño Southern Oscillation, well over 30 years, we've mapped out both how it impacts many regions independently and how predictable it is. But we haven't necessarily put those pieces together. And at a time over those 30 years, our food system has really dramatically transformed. And so the aspects of the El Niño Southern Oscillation that become so relevant have really evolved as our food systems have evolved.
You mentioned your time in the reinsurance industry. We're still not using crop predictability to robustly inform crop insurance and then reinsurance, which is the insurance that insurers use to protect themselves. Do you think that shifts anytime soon, given that we, as we said earlier, we do know so much more now about coming climate patterns and their impacts on regional crop yields?
You know, I think that some of these challenges stem from a difference of disciplines, and some of these challenges stem from the specifics of the application and the socioeconomic constraints on folks. So I'll give an example of each. I was on a crop tour in Zimbabwe. I was talking to an agronomist, and he produces crop yield forecasts for the end of the season based on conditions partway through. And he told me that he remembered Mark Kane, who is my advisor at Columbia, and who 30 years ago detailed how the El Niño Southern Oscillation could be used to predict maize failures. And this agronomist told me how he remembered Mark Kane coming and giving this presentation and how they all laughed him out of the room, that it was just such an absurd idea that you could predict a crop failure up to 6 months, 7 months in advance before seeds have even gone in the ground in some case. But to climate scientists, it's almost such conventional wisdom that you can understand a drought in Southern Africa based on a forecast of ENSO, which, as we mentioned, have been forecast up to 9 months in advance. This is just common knowledge. It's almost boring. And there's this real divide between disciplines there. I do want to recognize, though, that in some cases, the capacity of a farmer to use information like that on a predictive basis may really be limited by their socioeconomic situation. So in the US, if you're a large-scale farmer that can sort of play the odds, so to speak, and you can incorporate this information that is probabilistic in terms of the likelihood of drought, and you can forego profits perhaps or change what you're planting, you know, that's great. And that's kind of a best case scenario. But there are parts of the world where even if you have this information, your socioeconomic constraints prevent you from planting a different crop that may get you a lower price at the market because you can't afford to forego the possibility of the profit of that higher crop. And I think it's so important that you're out there having these conversations, because we need to be identifying where we can be taking advantage of this information and really building out the understanding and the systems to do so.
Yeah, let me see if I can extend the metaphor a little bit here. You said playing the odds. You can't walk up to a table in Vegas without any money in your pocket. And same is true for farmers all around the world. In order to take advantage of the probabilistic assessments, which are not perfect assessments, we should say also, you need to have a little bit of money in your pocket already.
Yep, absolutely. And at long lead times, these are really akin to something like loading the dice towards drought or towards good growing conditions. They're not deterministic. And that's one of the challenges. And that's part of the disconnect between the agronomists that I was talking to in Zimbabwe and the sorts of information we can provide. At very long lead times, it's just not possible to say we are certainly going to see a drought. But at the same time, if you were to get betting odds in Vegas, like what you see for Kansas wheat yields and their correlation to La Nina in the Eastern Pacific or to maize yields in Southern Africa, I mean, I'd be making a lot more money than I am now. This is a really clear instance in both of those cases where you are strongly loading the probability of either poor or good outcomes depending on the El Nino-Southern Oscillation.
The other factor here is that we continue to farm in places that still have more good years than bad years, even under climate warming. And so if you're making the same bet year after year in a place that for 100 years has produced a crop, it might be producing that crop a little bit less now and a little bit less effectively now under climate warming. But the places that have now more bad years than good years, those places have been largely abandoned as farmlands. And so people are still making these bets in a condition in which they will win slightly more than they will lose just based on natural climate variability.
Yeah, yeah. And as the climate is changing, it's not just that the mean state or the average state of the climate is changing. We're not just getting a little warmer in some places, maybe a little drier. It's not just about is climate change slightly lowering crop yields. In many places, it's really increasing volatility. It's making these bad years particularly bad. And being able to understand that and adapt to that as a farmer is not always straightforward, because you have to be able to try and disentangle these long-term signals from natural variability.
So we've been talking here about the challenges to implementing this knowledge locally. And those challenges are clearly very vast and nuanced, all the more difficult to do so globally. And in 2021, you suggested that as a global scientific community, we deserved about a C+ for our efforts to use what we know about ag climate connections to build warming systems for global food trade. I feel like you might have even been grading on the curve there, being a little more generous than we deserve. But where are we now? It's been a few years.
You know, I don't think that there is any single answer to that, because the way that this plays out is not through a single system for all applications, but rather through many systems for every user-specific application. And the reason that I say that is that the use of large-scale crop yield forecast systems, for example, doesn't have a single user, but it has many. So you may be interested in it for predicting food insecurity in chronically food insecure areas. You may be interested in it for major agricultural markets. Perhaps this is for global reinsurance companies. Perhaps This is for individual farmers, and each of these end users have specific needs. And so I can speak to our progress in the food security early warning system, which has really been vast. The improvement that we've seen over the last decade in our ability to monitor crop yields globally and to predict failures has really improved, and particularly in areas where we have little to no monitoring systems on the ground, or we're fairly information sparse. And so I think in that way, we're making very real progress in our ability to both monitor and predict the pattern and the structure of these crop failures. And that's improving our ability to extend the lead time that we have for crop failures and for the associated food insecurity that often follows.
You began looking at agroclimatological connections in Eastern Africa. This past year in Southern Africa, countries like South Africa, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana were facing their worst drought in many years. And these are areas where El Nino tends to be bad for crops. And we had a short-lived El Nino in 2023 in the spring of 2024 as those crops were going into the ground. And one of the things that's really tragic about this is that the World Meteorological Organization warned in May of 2023 that the chance of El Nino developing later in that year was increasing. But you say that governments failed to prepare that time around.
Yeah, and this is perhaps coming back to some of those socioeconomic constraints. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to focus on the real success story from this, and that's that we were able to forecast successfully this strong El Nino nearly a year in advance, right? You were talking about how in May there is this forecast, the El Nino developed in Boreal Falls, so around September. It persisted until the following spring. We're really seeing lead times of 9 months or more on exceptionally accurate forecasts for both the El Nino and the associated warnings of the potential impacts. So the famine early warning system from USAID started releasing reports detailing the likely implications of this for all sorts of livelihoods, crop production, and food security consequences throughout Southern Africa at the same time. And so we can really get in the information out there well in advance of the drought even materializing, let alone the consequential food security impacts.
Can I break in here and say, like, in January of 2024, you were part of a team that warned that Malawi's harvest — Malawi's a very small nation in Southern Africa — so Malawi's harvest of maize specifically could fall by, and I love the specificity of this, although it's a tragic prediction, but 22.5% in the coming year. That's how specific, both at a regional scale and also, you know, sort of like portending out what's going to, predicting out what's going to happen. That's how specific we can get now in these sorts of predictions.
Yeah, and Malawi is a regional breadbasket for Southern Africa. So it's a small country, but it's very important for food production and for maize production in particular. And so there again, while you can't say this is what will certainly happen with very long lead time, we can highlight the very real risks. And that allows us to start considering what are policy options, what are the potential ways that we can mitigate this. And those sorts of early warnings, they save lives, right? I mean, they prevent something that we have no control over, like a drought, from cascading into crop failures and hunger as a result of it. And it lets us sort of get ahead of it, at least to the extent possible.
That's Weston Anderson. He's an agroclimatologist at the University of Maryland who studies the dynamics of climate variability and its relation to food security. And many of his recent studies relate to how climate models can offer insights into crop yields at a global scale. Weston Anderson, thank you.
Thank you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, and from listeners like you, you can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Let go have big ideas.